Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I enjoyed the program very much last week. This is a rather different topic from the workshop last week, which was on fundamental symmetries. I thought I would try to discuss a little bit about neutron stars, and in particular the microphysics of neutron stars from a nuclear physics point of view. I think there's been a lot of progress in our understanding and prospects for much more better understanding of neutron stars. So we're kind of interested in two aspects of neutron stars. We're interested in learning about neutron stars themselves. What are their properties? What are the dynamics of neutron stars? But we're also interested in the phase diagram of QCD, which is a very important property of nuclear physics. So let me just start a little bit with the phase diagram of QCD. My drawing skills are not great, but our knowledge is similarly not great. We know a lot here. This is the temperature chemical potential plane. So we know a lot along this axis from experiment, but also from lattice QCD. And around temperature of 150 MeV, there's a crossover between pions, nucleons, a gas of hadrons, and the quark matter. And this is a crossover. It's a fairly sharp crossover, but we know that that's a crossover. The simulations are accurate enough to know that. It's speculated that there's a critical point here, and phase transition between nucleons or hadronic degrees of freedom and a quark gluon plasma up here, and if you make it cold enough, color superconducting state. So this is quarks, and they're paired because they have attractive interactions. And you know a lot about this at asymptotically high density. So if you make the density high enough, you can use perturbative QCD to calculate the equation of state. And people have done some very impressive calculations coming in from this end using analytic techniques. You also know quite a bit, if you go here to a chemical potential of about 930 MeV, you start to make nucleons, so you can go from here on basically using nuclear physics. What we don't know is how far you can go. We don't know really much of anything about where this transition takes place. We know that it has to asymptotically be a color superfluid. And in particular, we don't know where neutron stars are on this axis. So that's the observational consequence of the equation of state at low temperature and high density. It is basically neutron stars. We know nuclear physics, nuclei exist around here. We know it's color superconductors. So this is what we're interested in learning about, and we're going to try to learn about it as best we can by studying nuclear physics and neutron stars. Lattice QCD, I'll mention a little bit at the end. It's very difficult to reach this regime because it's very cold and very dense fermions. It's much worse than a condensed matter problem when you have cold fermions, because you actually, the signal to noise is governed by the difference between bosons and fermions, and bosons in this case are a gas of pions. And so you have the mass difference between a pion and a nucleon that's making your signal to noise worse. Nevertheless, I think there are things we can do there. So a similar plot which shows the properties of a neutron star, I should say first a little bit about what neutron stars are. They were proposed almost immediately after the discovery of a neutron. It's kind of amazing. They're supported by Pauli pressure of neutrons. Basically, you convert to neutrons because to make it charge neutral. You have a collapse of a 10 to 30 solar mass star into something of radius about 12 kilometers, so more or less from here to Santa Barbara, and a mass of 1 to 2 times the sun's mass. So it's very dense. Typically, the density is from a little bit less to a few times the density of nuclear matter itself, at saturation density. But it's almost all neutrons. That's because you need to make it neutral, and electrons are very light, so you don't want to have too many electrons. So you have like 90-95% neutrons. That actually simplifies the nuclear physics a little bit, because the interaction between neutrons is a little bit simpler than between neutrons and protons. So neutron stars are everywhere. There's, you know, hundreds of thousands in our galaxy, but only a few of them can you see. If they're sitting there by themselves, after the supernova explodes, it's very difficult to measure any properties of a neutron star. But if they're in binaries, or if they're accreting matter from another star, you can observe properties of them, and that's one of the main ways we're learning about neutron stars. So one of the main properties we'd like to know about neutron stars are, what are their masses? And what are the radii? So this is basically the density. The radii, I told you the masses are from 1 to 2x the solar mass. That's the one of the ones we know of. In principle, it could be a bit higher or a bit lower. If I had drawn you a plot, if you know the equation of state of neutron matter, so you know the ground state energy, neutron stars after a few years are basically zero temperature objects as far as nuclear physics is concerned, or at least as far as the mass radius is concerned. And so after those few years, if you know the ground state energy as a function of density, or equivalently the pressure as a function of density, you can just plot the mass and radius. If I'd done that, say, 5 to 10 years ago, there'd be almost a space-filling curves here. There's some models that look like this. This is of order, let's say, 15 to 20 kilometers. This is of order 10 kilometers. There's models which predicted a very early phase transition to color superfluid that went like that. There are models where the things went up and collapsed into another state. You either created hyperons or had kaon condensation, meson condensation. All different things are possible. And this could be, for a long time we've known that there are neutron stars with masses of order 1.4 and 1.6 solar masses. So all models basically were fixed to at least give you a 1.4 to 1.6 solar mass neutron star.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
So are all these curves different families of neutron stars, or are you indicating a band?
Well, I think basically you expect these to reach thermal equilibrium and have a one particular. This is just basically reflecting our lack of knowledge about the equation of state of neutron stars. Now, people have suggested that there are metastable states which you could reach, which would give you a totally different curve. But the general expectation is that there is one curve describing the mass radius of neutrons.
And these are different people's ideas for what the curve might be?
Yes.
Is that what I got?
Yes.
And what about rotation?
Rotation is a fairly modest effect. It's of order half a kilometer or less, depending on the rotation speed. I mean, some neutron stars rotate extremely fast, yeah, as you probably know. But that's a fairly modest effect on this, although it does place some limits on the fast ones if they're big enough. It does.
Nothing close to the shedding speed? Or?
Yeah.
That's an observational statement?
I mean, there's not, okay, I'll describe the observations in a little bit. There's not that much information yet known about observations are much better than they were, but they still could be improved. So, yeah.
Is the radius observable in principle?
Yeah, I will get to that. In principle, it is. And I'll try to describe as best I can what is known now over the last few years and what the uncertainties are, to give you an idea. Okay, so as I said, these curves come from knowing the basically ground state energy of neutron matter as a function of density. This is an interesting problem which has overlaps in condensed matter and AMO physics. George Birch had proposed that the zero effective range infinite scattering length problem as a model of neutron matter even before all the cold atom experiments happened. And so what you need to know to get those curves is what happens, what is the energy, and to make unitless, dimensionless parameter, I'll just divide by the Fermi gas energy. And on the horizontal axis, I'll plot the density over the saturation density of matter. That's nuclear saturation density. Neutrons, of course, are not bound, but nuclear self-bound, they all have essentially the same density. And it's about 0.16 nucleons per cubic Fermi. So if you have the system where the scattering length is very large, in cold atom systems, you can, of course, adjust that through Feshbach resonances. In neutrons, that's fixed to be about 18 Fermis. The effective range is about 2.5 Fermis. So it's not exactly like cold atoms because the effective range is a tenth of the scattering length rather than basically zero. If you have this, and there was, of course, analytic work near free Fermi gas. So for KFA, so this is basically KFA cubed as you're going in this direction. The energy over the Fermi gas, of course, at zero density, is 1 by definition. And analytically, you know how this drops from calculations of Li and Yang a long time ago. You know a few terms there. And in fact, it drops like a rock. But if you just plot cold atoms, you know this number for infinite scattering length is, from both experiments and theory, is about 0.37. So there are MIT cold atom experiments where they condense a cloud and other places, and they can measure this quite accurately. It's less than 1 in this digit. You can also do calculations of this. What we've been doing is quantum Monte Carlo. This has some good and bad points. The good point is if you do infinite scattering length and zero effective range, there's only 1 scale in the problem. That makes any simulation much easier. You don't need a really huge simulation to study the properties of the system. The difficulty is it's not, you know, it's far from a free Fermi gas. You have a pretty good idea through work of Leggett and others what's going on. It's the BCS to BEC crossover. And so you can put that into your simulations. There's no sign problems because it's a purely attractive interaction, and you can get the equation of state quite accurately. And in fact, you can get, basically by looking at perturbation theory at very low density, you can look at the difference between cold atoms and neutron matter and get that well described as well. Anyway, by the time you're about to 0.025, so some tiny density of the saturation density, this energy over the Fermi gas energy is around 0.5. And that's basically experimentally determined from cold atoms, but simulations, many body simulations of all different kinds, path integral, Monte Carlo, coupled cluster, other variational approaches, all give you something like this 0.5. Interesting thing about neutron matter, if you do these same approaches and extend them to up to around saturation density, even though it's no longer anything like the unitary Fermi gas, the energy flattens out and it's still about half the Fermi gas energy. So it's very flat over this region. This is the region where you can learn something from experimental nuclear physics and low-density neutron matter. People try to understand the equation of state of neutron matter by doing different kinds of experiments on nuclei, looking at the low-energy dipole responses where you move neutrons and protons, looking at just the masses of nuclei and seeing what they look like as you increase the fraction of neutrons. It's not a very direct measurement because no nuclei are anything like the matter here, which is of order 95% neutrons and 5% protons. But you can get a pretty good description. And then as you go further, by the time you get about to twice to three times rho naught here, the equation of state has shot up in your back up here, close to the Fermi gas energy, which is like around, depending on exactly what you pick, around 50 or 60 MeV. Okay, so that's coming just from the fact you're starting to feel the repulsion between neutrons at short distances. Neutrons at very low energy, they're almost bound into dineutrons. That's the unitary regime. And as you get to higher and higher energy, the interaction becomes repulsive, and you're starting to feel that here, and you're back up to around the saturation. So that makes that supports the neutron star. That gives you a curve. If you take this curve here, you get something in this region for the neutron star mass radius. And basically, that is pretty well determined. Here, it's very accurately determined, like to 10%. Here, it's a little bit less. The energy of neutron matter at saturation density is about plus or minus 20% if you look at all different models. And here, you know, I put this error bar, but that was a huge mistake. You know, it's like this. And that's because other things start to come into play here. Oh, when you're down here at half saturation density or below, basically you're purely determined by neutron-neutron scattering, the many-body system. But as you go to higher densities, you know, your neutrons, there are low-lying excited states of neutrons, and they could be represented if you're doing a hadronic model by things like three-body forces. This is one example of a three-body force. There's others as well. You can do this in chiral perturbation theory. And you have things with a contact operator between two neutrons and a pion exchange. And you have things of two pion exchange range. There's not a whole lot that we know about the three-body forces, especially at high densities. At low densities, we can calculate nuclei, and so we have some idea what's happening. We can calculate different nuclei. Those are, especially for few-body systems, you can do pretty much exact calculations. And there's some indication that the three neutron force, is attractive at low density. So if you took the pure two-body force, it would give you a smaller radius down here somewhere. But on general grounds, at higher density, people expect the three neutron force to be rather repulsive, and that pushes you up, and it would push this up to the higher end of this error bar here.
Can you see?
Yeah.
Yeah, so is the 0.5 supposed to be approximation to the 0.37? I mean, do you expect?
Well, okay, it's not exactly. So if you do quad atom experiments, right, there's this xi, which is for zero effective range, you know, so this is not a KFA of infinity, right? This is finite KFA. So you can look at the plot, and we've actually done this. You can look at things like the contact or the ratio of the energy over the Fermi gas energy. And you can plot it for cold atoms, so zero effective range. You can do this calculation exactly like what you did to get to the 0.37. So this, for cold atoms, this is eventually, you know, way off to the board, is going to go to 0.37. If you do the same calculation for neutron matter, you get this about 0.5, and the difference here is coming from this effective range expansion. And you can do the calculation even with a finite effective range without sign problem or anything. So you can explain this difference just from the effective range of the neutron.
And the second crossover is you're hitting densities reaching the separation, reaching the
separation between basically the size of nucleons, which is of order of Fermi. And
set by the effective range, basically?
No, that's going beyond. So the effective range is basically describing the next order expansion. So if you look at the phase shifts of neutrons, two neutrons interacting. So if you plot the phase shift as a function of energy, you have almost a bound state, so it goes up really rapidly. So it's pi over 2. If you had codons with zero effective range, it would just stay there. But what neutrons do is they go down like this, and they eventually become repulsive. So it's not just the effective range. It's beyond that. Two nucleons are repulsive at high energies or short distances. And that's what's giving you this increase in the energy or the pressure when you go to high density. There's a lot of other things that we'd like to know about neutron stars. I'm kind of emphasizing the very basic property, the equation of state. But you also want to know things like the superfluid gaps in neutron matter. That affects things like the cooling of neutron stars, how they couple to neutrinos, which is the dominant cooling mechanism for early times. And it matters a lot whether you have gaps, because these gaps can be similar in size to what happens in cold atoms for S waves at very low density, at least. So in cold atoms, if you have superfluid gaps at unitarity, so at infinite scattering length, it's almost half the Fermi energy of the system. So it's huge compared to anything else. They're almost bosons, right? You're not over to the BEC side, but you are have very high superfluid gaps. In neutron matter, the calculations show that the ratio of the gap to the Fermi energy goes as a maximum of about a third. When you get to higher density, you start feeling this repulsion, so it's at least not S-wave superfluid anymore. But it is, in this low density region or low energy region, you have substantial S-wave pairing. And a very interesting question is what happens as you increase the density. Although the S wave phase shift looks like this, the P wave phase shift, or triplet P2, I should say, looks like this. So you may have a triplet P2 superfluid up to very high densities. There's even a D wave that's attractive here. And where exactly these happen, the magnitude, and whether there's regions of energy which have no superfluidity matter a lot to the cooling. Of course, it's very difficult to exactly determine these things, but there's been a lot of progress in the cold atoms in the S wave. We can compare to the simple calculations of cold atoms and get a pretty good understanding of the superfluid gap. I know that there's been a lot of progress in cold atoms in making things like Hubbard models and more complicated interactions with optical lattices recently. So if we could do a little bit more complicated interaction as we have in nuclear physics, that would be awesome, and we could tell a lot more about this. Because here, when you have triplet P2 pairing and so forth, typically there's some kind of sign problem. It doesn't affect the equation of state very much, but it probably does affect the superfluid gap. Yeah?
Before I came over here, I was talking to one of my colleagues, and I said, I'm going to go over here and do this talk on neutron stars, because a long time ago it was a big problem what the equation of state of nuclear matter was above nuclear densities, right? And I'm sure they've solved this, Right, I want to find out what the answer is.
Well, I'm, okay.
Now I find out that it's still a big problem.
Well, I think, yeah, okay, so some of that is just a setup, of course.
What should I take back to him to tell him what's the, just some quality?
Can I answer that question closer to the end?
Yeah.
Okay, one more thing I want to say about this region that we know a lot about. And that is, if you put particles in a trap, so if you put neutrons in a trap, nuclei, atoms, electrons in an atom or whatever, and you plot energy versus particle numbers, typically scaled in some reasonable way, so this is energy over n or n^4 if you're an harmonic oscillator or something. If you have fermions, you get something that looks like this. Right? You have closed shells. You're filling up the lowest shells, and energy per particle is a minimum at those shells. Cold atoms look very different at zero effective range. It's basically, even to very small n, it's basically a continuous treatment. That's because your pairing gap is so large, they basically look like bosons. And if you put systems in a box, there's no, if you have like free fermions in a box, there's huge gaps that come in when you fill the shells in periodic momenta. But when you have cold atoms, they're close enough to bosons, even at unitarity. It's very hard to pick out any gaps, numerically at least. So that'll come back at the very end. Okay, so what happens when we get to higher densities? As I said, we don't know that much about the equation of state. But even this kind of knowledge from the nuclear physics, which we think is probably valid to something like those densities, tells you quite a bit. And pretty much it tells you that unless there's some exotic metastable state, you know, the standard nuclear physics model would go something like this. This is kind of ruled out. Most of these models came from Mead and field theory, which didn't know anything about this behavior of the equation of state dropping so fast at such tiny energies. So what you know from nuclear physics was basically this, but still there are all kinds of curves going over here and saying, oh, if you make such dense matter 2 to 3 times rho naught, you can start making other particles. You can make, for example, other hadrons like lambdas. So lambdas just has strangeness. It's about 200 MeV heavier than a nucleon. So if you just put free lambdas, that will definitely happen. And your maximum mass will be somewhere around 1.5 solar masses. However, that's very depending on putting free lambdas. If you look at lambda hypernuclei, we know the ground state energy of hyperons in normal nuclei. We don't know too much about its isospin dependence yet, but we know the energy. We also know that it has a huge forces that are equivalent to this, basically three-body forces, because there's other excited state which are very close to that 200 MeV excitation. And if you make some simple models of lambda hypernuclei which fit the binding energies, this force, the two and three-body forces, are very important, and you can go all the way up to 2.4 solar mass neutron stars. So we don't have enough knowledge yet about these three body forces to really make predictions. But what really changed in 2010 was the observation by De Morris and company of a 2 solar mass neutron star. So they could measure that basically from the orbits, 2 rapidly rotating orbits of neutron stars. And so now immediately, anything that doesn't go up there is ruled out. Because you know that these things exist, there have now been another observation of a 2 solar mass neutron star. And so you know at least you have to go up to a 2 solar mass for your equation of state, which means you have to be pretty repulsive here. This is kind of the range of equations of states which will support that. Something like this. if you have sort of a 20-30% error in your equation of state, that will affect exactly where this happens. That will affect whether you have, you know, if you have low pressure or lower energy over there, you'll be following this lower curve, which is only going to, say, 2 solar masses. And if you have the higher pressure, you'll be going up here to about 2.4.
Are the observations actually 2 solar masses, or is there an inclination uncertainty and it could be higher?
Yeah, they study that, and it's the error bar. The original one came out as 1.97 plus or minus 0.04. That one was gone down to something at 1.93 plus or minus 0.04. But there's another one now which is also 1.97, and the error bar is still about 0.05.
But it's, there's not a sign I should find out. That's
no.
Really
no. No, that's sense. Yeah, that's taken into account. Yeah.
How do you measure the masses? You might have said missed it.
Yeah, sorry. I, it's basically from the orbits. So it has to be in a binary, and you have to measure various properties of the orbits. It's a pulsar, so you look at it when it's rotating around its partner. You get information on the orbits, and the Shapiro delay, which is a relativistic effect, is enough to give you the absolute mass of the neutron stars. So they're basically point particles. So the radii of the orbit is much bigger than this sort of 10, 20 kilometers. So there's enough information from the observations, basically, of the pulsars to tell you what is the mass of both objects in the pair.
But how are they glowing? Or, I mean, they're not like wooden stars.
No, these are X-ray pulsars, so they're emitting X-rays.
One of the observations, one of our companion was a white dwarf.
Yeah, they're binary neutron star systems, and there's also neutron star white dwarf systems. Those are the kind of things you can use to measure this because, you know, it has to be that the two systems are small enough so that tidal deformation or whatever is not making a big impact, and you can treat them basically as relativistic point particles orbiting each other.
And what are the X-rays from?
They're from, you know, these are, systems are pulsars. They're rotating and emitting X-rays. They can be accreting. There's lots of different kinds of measurements, and that also is used in somewhat different systems to look at the radii of neutron stars, to try to estimate the radii. So there's two kinds of measurements for the radii, which are mostly used right now. Those are quiescent binaries, or almost quiescent low mass X-ray binaries, and photospheric radius expansion bursts. So one is a very violent event. You accrete enough material on that basically there's a thermonuclear explosion over a big fraction of the surface of the star. It raises the atmosphere up. You look at it decaying, and that's enough information to give you some idea of the radii of neutron stars. There's also these quiescent low-mass X-ray binaries. They're a little more sensitive to things like what's the atmosphere of a neutron star. These neutron stars, of course, not pure neutron matter. They have things, there's a crust, and then there's the atmosphere, which is typically thought to be hydrogen or helium. And depending on what assumptions there you can make, you can get slightly different answers. And anyway, those measurements seem to be settling down. You know, whether this is a physics or sociological effect is up to the reader. But it's to something in this 10.5 plus or minus 1.5 kilometer region. So also something like this. And the different groups, you know, this is somewhat of a combined analysis. One group gets something that looks like this. They're mostly looking at these explosive events, and some other groups get something, they do overlap, so I shouldn't put it like that. But if I make some kind of combined system, I get something between, say, 9 and 12 or 13 kilometers for the radius of a neutron star from observations. But those have different systematics, but it's only two methods, and they do have systematic errors associated with them. So it's not exactly obvious what strict error bar you should put. If you're going to put a 5 sigma, it would certainly be bigger than plus or minus 1.5. Anyway, there's a lot more we can learn from observations. I think one of the most exciting things that we might be able to learn from in the future is the possibility of gravitational waves. So the gravitational waves, as you don't, no doubt know, have been observed, but from black hole binaries, and from rather massive black hole binaries. They're of order 10 solar masses each. So as you can imagine, the signal from a neutron star merger will be much weaker than from a black hole merger. But certainly the advanced LIGO was designed to be able to detect things down to two solar mass objects merging. And the way that works is, again, at early times, when the binary system is emitting gravitational waves, you can basically treat it as point particles. Okay, so it depends only on the masses of the two systems. But eventually, you'll reach a point where you'll introduce a quadrupole deformation of the neutron star. And that will increase the radiation and change the frequency. So depending upon how big it is, basically this is all coming from a quadrupole deformation, which you can treat basically from the equation of state. That deformation is in principle measurable from gravitational waves if you can get enough accuracy in the signal at late times before they go into either a very heavy mass neutron star, if that exists, or more likely they go into a black hole. So from this, you may be able to learn a lot more about what's the maximum mass neutron star. We know it has to be at least two. Different models give between 2 and 2.4 solar mass neutron stars. And also about the radius. And as you can see from the way I've tried to draw these curves, this fact that your equation of state is very attractive at low density and becomes very repulsive at high density gives you an almost vertical mass radius relation over quite a range of masses. And of course, you'd like to be able to determine observationally if that's a true statement. This is still to be tested, and the degree to which it's true, it certainly remains to be tested. So are there other questions about this? Okay, let me just go back for a few minutes to this original thing we started with, which was the phase diagram of QCD. So there's no obvious evidence from the current observations that we see anything like this phase transition. It may happen in the future. We don't have that accurate of information yet. The phase transition generically would be some softening of the equation of state or some break in the equation of state if it's a first order at least. So you need to much more accurate information to be able to tell that. But of course, we know what the QCD interaction is. So in principle, we should be able to calculate and try to determine where this phase transition happens. That is, as I said, extremely difficult because these are fermions. And you have, as in all many-body quantum problems, you have a signal-to-noise ratio associated with the sign of the fermions. So for condensed matter or nuclear physics or something, you have a signal-to-noise ratio which decays with imaginary time or inverse temperature, basically from the difference between the bosonic and the Fermi energy. So this depends on your system. For liquid helium or something where it's extremely repulsive at short distances, this is actually allows you to go pretty far, and you can get a pretty good description of many, at least bulk properties of fermions. For nuclear physics, this is not so great, but still not bad. For electrons, it's, you know, if you can treat the system in mean field, or if you do, if you're far away from phase transitions, it's pretty good. But for lattice QCD, the relevant quantity is e to the minus tau times the number. This is all number of fermions and bosons should have been in there. The number of fermions and bosons times the nucleon mass minus 3/2 the pion mass. So you have three quarks. And the square comes in as six quark lines. And so you can only go very short imaginary times, especially for large systems. So we're not able yet to do large systems down in this low temperature regime. There's some work to try to go over to this phase transition as we basically use Taylor expansion to try to understand where this critical point may be. But it's very hard to do simulations down here. But what you can do is exploit this particle number. So for a few particles, you can still do the simulations. So for example, when you did the cold atoms, these are all fermions, but you can do these few particle systems quite accurately just because the total energy is only a small multiple of the energy per particle, which is governing the signal to noise. So we're doing simulations now, and I know some of the lattice gauge theory groups are doing it as well, of just a few particle, a few nucleons in a box. So you can, for example, put you might imagine the first thing we thought when we started doing this, okay, in periodic boundary conditions and two species of nucleons, spin up and spin down neutrons. The first closed shell is at 7 spin up and 7 spin down. So we thought, okay, you'll just look here and see what happens. And if you have this quark, even though it's a very small system, you won't be able to get a phase transition very precisely. But you can understand at least roughly what are the appropriate degrees of freedom and try to put this on some reasonable physical scale of where the phase transition might happen. That's very hard, of course, in lattice gauge theory because 14 nucleons is of order 50 quarks, and the contractions and the technical challenge of that is large, in addition to the sign problem being very bad. But we find that even very small numbers of nucleons look very different if you have nucleonic degrees of freedom versus anything like paired quarks. The lattice gauge theory guys have not completed their simulations yet, but we have results where we can show the things with four nucleons paired in p wave with extra two neutrons. So you have two neutrons sitting at p equals zero, at momentum zero, and the other two, you can put them in basically a symmetric, so the wave function is symmetric under rotations of the cube. You could put them in P waves, something which, of course, it's cubic symmetry, but it basically looks like triplet P2. And this is actually a lower energy state at higher densities than the S wave symmetry. And this is presumably very different from the pairing pattern you'd see from color superfluidity. You can even make, since it's two P waves, you could turn it into a D wave. That, at least in some models, is also lower in energy than the fully symmetric state. And it's basically because the mass is so different of a nucleon compared to a quark, even if you say a dress quark, a constituent quark, the behavior you'd expect is extremely different between nucleons and quarks. And we're hoping that will eventually let us pin something purely from microscopic physics of where this phase transition takes place. We're not yet sure, of course, which will happen first, the determination from astrophysical observations, which can cover a certain regime of density from, say, 2 to 5 or 6 times nuclear density, or from the calculations. But there's certainly an interesting interplay going forward.
The high temperature part with the critical endpoint, that's well studied numerically?
I wouldn't say well studied. Okay, so that's, right now what they have is extremely well studied is basically chemical potential zero. So that's equivalent, more or less equivalent to a half-filled Hubbard model. So there's no sign problem. You can do this no problem. You see a fairly smooth crossover at this temperature with a width of, I don't know, 10 or 20 MeV. It's a pretty sharp crossover. What they're trying to do is basically put small chemical potentials on here and extrapolate and see when things blow up, when their sign problem blows up, and try to understand. Experimentally, what they're doing, if you go to very high energy, like at the LHC, you don't keep a very high baryon chemical potential. Basically, quarks and antiquarks are almost equal. But if you go to lower energies, the RIC accelerator is going to go to low energy, do what they call the beam energy scan, and try to explore this region around here. Of course, that's shooting two nuclei at each other, and going back and extracting the equation of state is a non-trivial thing. But it's very important.
So there's also the old causality limit that I know Jim worked on.
Yeah. Okay. That certainly is there. And yes, I did a terrible job of drawing this as usual. And the causality limit is something like that. If I've drawn this correctly, these curves curve over more. And causality, of course, these are simplified non-relativistic models. So they can violate causality, but if you throw out models that violate causality, you tend to get something like this. Also very interesting, there are papers coming out saying that if you take these equations of state down here, if you'd have a simple, like, free quark model of QCD, the highest speed of sound you'd get is speed of light over square root of 3. And the statement is that these things, even if you believe it up to, say, twice rho naught, where the error bar is not quite so bad, that you're required to go over that 1 over the square root of 3 in order to keep the two solar mass neutron star. That depends a little bit. Even the two-body force is, you know, not perfectly known or implemented here. So I don't think that's totally proven yet, but it's certainly extremely intriguing. What is the maximum speed of sound in a strongly interacting system?
But it's going to matter a lot for LIGO, because if we can get two neutron stars, they can still leave a neutron star behind.
Right.
Not go into a black hole.
Right.
That expectation is a different signal.
Yeah.
And a different, potentially, optical counterpart.
Yeah.
1.3 times 2 is 2.6 modulo. Gravitational losses, it's close. Things are getting close.
Yeah. So that's really exciting to know sort of the typical radius of neutron stars. If you have a 1.4 solar mass neutron star, it's probably, you know, not, the radius is determined mostly by physics at this twice saturation density and below for a 1.4 solar mass. But if you start pushing here, either maximum mass or the radius of a very heavy neutron star, then you're potentially learning a lot more about the higher density part of the equation of state.
How important are relativistic
events here? Yeah, they are not so bad. Around 2 rho naught, but as you go up, they can be pretty important. But it's not only relativistic effects, it's effects of excitation, other excitations in the medium. This, at lower densities, we're using a nucleons-only model. And there's, of course, as I said, lambdas at 200 MeV excitation. Just in vacuum, that's what they are. It's not totally clear what they'd be in the medium. There's been discussion of bosonic or meson condensates in the medium, and there's, of course, deltas, all kinds of excitations of the medium. To study that, you really need to use the lattice QCD approach.
neutron star before you guys have solved your homework problem? Or?
I don't know.
High LIGO, that doesn't sound good at all.
Well, yeah, depends on who I talk to. If I talk to Dan Holtz, who I know is here not too long ago and gave a talk, he said, neutron stars, oh, that's going to be a waste. But other people are more optimistic.
On your density graph, where's the range where these nuclear pasta phases come in?
This is a very low density, so I did not really talk about that. The neutron star in the outer region has a crust, and it can have finite proton fraction, and that's sort of at the outer surface of the neutron star. And those are low densities, much, much below nuclear matter density. So that affects some of the dynamics quite a bit, can affect things like cooling or glitches and things, but it doesn't affect too much the mass radius relation, because that's determined by the bulk of the star, which is named here.
Is there any other way of telling if there's a color superconductor phase other than just seeing transition and some other signal if you're in that phase?
People have looked at things like neutrino emission and cooling. In principle, that is also a signal, because neutrinos are basically the only thing that can get out of the dense interior of a neutron star right away. Right? I mean, other things, it will take them a long time to get out. But calculations typically of transport coefficients, pairing gaps, things like that, are more difficult than the calculation of the equation of state. So observationally, it's a very intriguing possibility, and maybe you'd see a fundamentally different signal. But as far as calculations go, it's probably hard to go that route.
Can you remind me how, if there was a color superconducting phase, how the two solar mass neutron stars still is viable? How does that hold together?
Well, there is a two solar mass neutron star, but you don't know where this is, so it has to be, you know, the phase transition has to be up at fairly high density. It can't be like at this. It doesn't seem possible. People are clever, so you never know. But it doesn't seem likely it's below something like 2 rho naught. But if you push it up to high, it only is going to affect the very interior of the neutron star, and it won't make such a big impact.
How will you see the phase transition in astrophysical observation? What will you see?
Well, I think there are two things you could potentially see. One is if you can accurately measure this, so if it's not a big band like this, but it's a curve, if it's a first order phase transition, you should see some break in the mass radius. You know, it'll be continuous, but there. People like Mark Alford at Washington University have studied that and described various possibilities. You can have even more exotic things than that. But that requires a fairly accurate determination of the mass radius relation for different binaries of neutron stars, or this thing that we just talked about, the neutrinos coming from neutron stars.
Can you say a bit more again how your astrophysical observations back out this? I mean, the mass I can see, but the radius of the neutron star, how do they?
Yeah, it's not easy. So these bursts are a little bit easier. There's an Eddington limit, which is basically telling you the maximum amount of radiation that can come off as the whole surface of the neutron star explodes. And basically, you get an area from that, and that is telling you about the radius of the neutron star.
So what do they actually see? So I don't understand. So they see. I understood that you have the X-rays, which are. Yeah. The rotation axis is not aligned to the magnetization axis, which gives you the pulsar and a pulsar.
But this is coming from accreting matter onto the system until there's enough matter there that there's a thermonuclear burn on the surface. So this particular thing, unlike the pulsar spinning and getting the mass, it is coming from the radius or the area of the surface, which is a large fraction of the radius of the whole neutron star. So you can use that to place a limit. I can give you some references.
I just want to see what are they actually observing. What are they actually
observing? The mass of neutron stars, which is something we worked on about 15 years ago, what we're seeing there are neutron stars at a known distance. They're in a globular cluster, so you actually know the distance of the neutron star. So if you see an atmosphere, and you measure, of course, you don't know the distance from the observation, but what you get is the peak brightness and the surface temperature. If you have a good atmospheric model of the physics, and those are good because they're mostly pure hydrogen, so it's a little bit easier. And if you tell me the distance, and I've got a peak brightness and a temperature, I can give you a radius. And that's the game for the quasi neutron stars.
But it's just an X-ray burst. It's not a
pulsation. These are not bursts. Those are not bursts.
Those are two different things, yeah.
Persistent.
Stefan Boltzmann.
Pardon me?
It's just Stefan Boltzmann. Yeah.
It's Stefan Boltzmann with a funny atmosphere.
With a funny
atmosphere.
Yeah.
Okay. Correction. So it's not quite so. So I would say those are a little bit better than the thermonuclear bursts.
It is a subject of some contention, so I'm sure you're well aware. Yeah.
So we still don't have a gravitational redshift, iron line, K-edge, anything like that? Is there any hope?
Yeah.